Virginia, as a matter of fact.
And from 53?
Yeah.
Oh, so did...
Well, I came to... I finished my coursework for a doctorate at the University of Virginia in 53.
Did you know Bob Black? That's a
yes, oh sure, I knew Bob. I knew Tom Sanders. Is Tom still around? Tom Sanders, I think, went to work for the Richmond Fed. But maybe he retired very early, I don't know. You know that name?
No.
Tom Sanders? Oh, okay.
No.
Well, yeah, I knew Bob Black, and Bob and I chatted from time to time over the years. I guess he's retired now, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
So, I finished my coursework at the university in 53, and under the tutelage of Ray Mikesell. And do you know Ray Mikesell or know of him?
No, I do not. I know the name, but I do not know him.
And he was an old World War II OSS colleague of a fellow named Charlie Coombs.
That's interesting.
Who was the chief of the Foreign Research Division of the New York Fed, and Ray called Charlie and recommended me to him, and I went up and Charlie interviewed me and hired me.
Hmm. Coombs had been a classmate of Kennedy's at Harvard.
Who?
Coombs had been a classmate of Kennedy's
at oh, yeah.
Harvard.
So I had still had my dissertation to finish, and I went to work for the New York Fed in May of 53, and worked on the dissertation nights and weekends, and it was accepted, and took my final orals and so on, and was awarded the PhD in Charlottesville in 1955.
So you went into the research department.
That's right.
And what kinds of work were you involved in before you went to the open market desk?
My first job was in the this was the Foreign Research Division, and it was broken down geographically, and I was assigned to the Western European Unit, as they called it, and then went from there to the Latin American Unit, and then in 1955, a rather peculiar thing happened. The New York Fed, looking around, decided that it had a lot of economists, and some of whom might have some ability beyond economic research, and somehow or other, and they wanted to select some of these people to move into other areas of the bank.
So that happened with Bob Rose and Peter Sternlight, too,
yeah,
I guess,
well,
about the same
that's
time.
Right. And Bob Rose had already been the head of, well, he was number two in research at that time, following mm-hmm. Harold Rolsey was the head of research.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they somehow fixed upon me and asked me if I wanted to transfer to the personnel department, of all places.
Mm.
And I said, well, yes, provided a bridge room back to research remains open. I don't want to burn that bridge. Well, of course, they agreed to that. And I spent a couple of years in the personnel department. It really turned out to be a very interesting thing. It was a new dimension for me, and also it was very useful because I got to know the rest of the bank very well. And in the course of my getting to know other people in the bank, they came to know me. And in 1958, they needed a very junior officer in the open market function. And they made me an officer and gave me that job. And 4 years later, to my astonishment, I was running the open market account. So that's the background.
And kind of tied on the other end, when did you leave the Fed?
In 65.
Mm-hmm. And where did you go then?
I went to the National Bank of Detroit and stayed there for 3 years and then left there. I got homesick for New York. And I got a very nice job offer from the Irving Trust in New York and went back and spent the next 20 years until my retirement then there at the Irving.
Did you continue to follow monetary policy or did
very
you...
much so. My responsibility at Irving was managing all their capital market activities, which of course included
when did you first attend an open market meeting?
February 1958. My job, let me say, the manager of the open market account in those days was Robert Rouse.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he sat at the table and gave his report as manager of the account. And my job was to sit in a circle or around the edge of the room with all the other staff members, and I took notes. When I got back to New York, I would write up those notes and give them to Mr. Rouse a day or two later. And those notes helped him recollect some of the things that were said at the meeting that he might otherwise have forgotten or had missed while they were being said.
None of those notes, as far as you know, ever made their way into the New York Fed archives, did they? They would be destroyed after?
Oh, yes, I think those were just for Mr. Rouse's use.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they ever found their way into any archive. No.
Well, early 58, the recovery from recession was in the works, but no one realized it at the time. Do you have any recollections over debates from your initial meetings over what the Fed should be doing given the recession? And at that time, had the Fed become concerned about balance of payments problems? Do you remember?
No, not at that point. I think my recollection is that that concern, which became a very major concern 3 or 4 years later,
mm-hmm.
concern began to develop probably around late 58, 59, but mm-hmm. I could be off on that.
Mm-hmm.
But the dollar shortage of the early 50s, a decade later, turned into the dollar glut.
Yes.
And I don't think it was recognized yet that a real glut was developing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can offer maybe a little bit of evidence on that. The recession of which you spoke began in the fall of 1957.
Right.
And when I joined the trading desk in February of 58, monetary policy was aggressively easy. My recollection is the federal funds rate got down to maybe 1/4 of 1% or 3/8 of 1%. That's pretty easy money.
Yeah.
But Bill Martin used to call them sloppy reserves.
But in congressional testimony, Martin has said that he thought that the Fed made a mistake coming out of the 53-54 recession and committed to later inflation, and he didn't want to make that mistake again. So I have the feeling that even though monetary policy was easy at that time, that it was on Martin's mind that they were not going to come out of the recession with, as you said, sloppy reserves for very long. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think his bias, if he had one, was not to ease excessively, not to so flood the banking system with reserves that they became, in his term, sloppy. And I guess a measure of that would be the federal funds rate. But I do recall that it got down to 1/4 of 1%, and three-month treasury bills got down to under 1%. Now, whether it was just then or a little bit later after the 1959 recession, I'm not quite sure. But, you can find that. You can look back in the Federal Reserve bulletins and find that. But the easing was so aggressive that the celebrated 2 5/8. We remember the episode of the 2 5/8. I think that was I think the Treasury sold a 5-year. No, I'm mixing that up. The Treasury sold some bonds with a coupon of 2 5/8, and they were taken up by heavy speculation. I think that was around May and June, May or June of 1958.
That sounds right.
May or June of 1958. And then financial columnist named Joe Slevin, who used to write for the New York Herald Tribune and who wrote a market letter as well, wrote a particular market letter on a particular day and expressed the view and gave support for the view that the economy was turning around and turning around rapidly, whereupon everybody tried to dump their 2 5/8 and it was discovered that the speculation in that bond had gone far beyond the bounds of usual speculation, in the sense that a lot of amateurs, including, it was said, the shoeshine people and everything else, had invested with little or no margin in the 2 5/8.
Yeah,
this gets back to the very low Fed funds rate.
Yeah, I just pulled up some interest rate figures through July of 1958. 5-year issues were somewhat below 2.5%.
Oh, right.
And the rate on new issues was less than 1%, 3-month bills.
Right, under 1%. And with Fed funds down at a quarter of 1% or whatever they were, it meant that the dealer loan rate was very low. And the dealer could buy $1 million worth of bonds in the name of the guy who shined his shoes in the morning and finance them at practically nothing with Fed funds rate that low. And there was a big spread between the dealer's financing costs and the 2.5 or 2 5/8 and so on. So it was very profitable until the market turned around, and then it went south in a great hurry.
Mm-hmm. Then I'm just looking at the figures here. Market rates pick up, reach almost 3%, short-term rates reach almost 3% by fall, then they fall back somewhat. When Martin wanted to change short-term rates, how did he do it? I've read the fair amount of the minutes from this period. The discussion in the meetings is very general, and the directive often goes for long periods without any sort of change. I mean, I get the strong feeling from reading these minutes, that Martin himself exercised considerable discretion over what short-term rates, what the funds rate was going to do, given the kind of broad parameters the FOMC set.
Well, my recollection is interest rates were never targeted. It was anathema to Martin and to others to target interest rates, and that grew out of the history of the days in World War II and thereafter, when the Fed at the behest of the Treasury pegged bond rates.
Yeah, but surely Martin.
And let me.
I'm sorry.
On. So, and then you had the whole bills only controversy. And that was the bills only policy was a reaction to the long and unhappy history of the Fed in pegging bond rates
right.
Its will, and the Fed didn't want to peg any interest rate. It didn't even want to mention short rates in its directive, and it did not in those days, in my recollection. And directions were very general, nobody, I think, dared in an open market committee meeting say, well, I think the Treasury bill rate should be thus and so, and we should add or supply reserves in order to keep the Treasury bill rate at thus and so. That was never said. Free reserves was the target, and free reserves, I think, in everybody's mind, was sort of a proxy for short rates, not an exact proxy, but sort of a proxy for short rates. If you move free reserves down, you know, everyone knew interest rates for short rates would go up a bit, and if you moved them up, interest rates would come down a bit. So we talked in terms of free reserves. And
but surely, I mean, Martin thought, looked through free reserves to interest rates, and the fact that the committee itself did not specify a specific target for interest rates gave Martin a degree of freedom to allow movements in interest rates that he considered desirable for example, 1959, when interest rates moved up strongly, and in the first part of the year, there was a change in the directive, and clearly the committee wanted interest rates to move up. But then in August and December of that year, interest rates moved up again, and there's no indication from the directive or from Martin's consensus statement or from the general discussion of FOMC minutes that the committee itself had made a decision to move rates up. But Martin, I mean, it looks like, going back and reading this period, that Martin was concerned about gold outflows, and he thought rates should move up, and he took advantage of the ambiguity in the procedures to kind of get the level of interest rates he thought was desirable.
Well, that's probably right, but he would do that. He would do that really through the medium of the FOMC. Martin never got on the telephone to New York and talked with the manager about what the manager should be doing with interest rates or reserves or anything else. I never had a single telephone call of that kind from Martin, nor I'm sure did my predecessor Bob Rouse ever have such a call.
That's interesting. I mean, given what I know about the Fed, it seems to me astounding that Steve Axelrod or whoever is not on the phone with the system open market account manager on a regular basis.
We had the 11 o'clock call. Maybe they still do that. I don't know.
Oh, sure.
You're familiar with the 11 o'clock call?
Yeah, actually, I'm missing it today because I'm talking to you, but I really would much rather talk to you than sit in on it. Yes, we still do it.
But the 11 o'clock call is usually taken by the board staff in Washington and one president of the of a regional bank. Presumably today it's the Richmond Fed
president.
Right,
yes.
And we would indicate in the course of the 11 o'clock call, we'd describe what was going on in the market and indicate what, if any, action the desk was going to take.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not in any sense asking anybody's permission to do that. We'd say, this is the action we're going to take. And if anybody at the other end of the call, either the Reserve Bank president or any member of the board staff, felt that that was the wrong action and felt sufficiently strongly that that was the wrong action, then I suppose that person could have gone to Bill Martin and please call this guy at the desk and tell him that he's off the track. But that never happened. Certainly not in my experience, and not in Bob Rouse's experience while I was working with him.
Mm. Okay, but I mean, I want to.
Well, let me go back a minute.
Yeah.
What I'm doing, I'm addressing your idea that Bill Martin somehow exercised an influence independently of the committee. I got that little feeling.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't think he did at all. I don't think he did at all. I think he was a very persuasive, strong leader. And what he might have said to other members of the Board of Governors when in their informal sessions, I don't know. But when you got the Open Market Committee meetings, which then were held every 3 weeks, not every six
right.
as they are now, every 3 weeks, there would be a go-around beginning with the New York Fed, as I recall it. The president of the New York Fed, I think, would go first. And they go around and the presidents of the regional banks, all of them, whether they were on the committee or not, would give a report on conditions in their district and then make their own recommendations as to whether policy should firm up a bit, ease off a bit, or remain the same. And it was expressed pretty much in those terms. And then it would come to Bill Martin. And he would have had the benefit of that discussion. And he would have made his judgment as to whether he would have support for any particular move he wanted to make, and then he would start to speak. And at the end, he would And his view usually carried the day. He was, a strong leader, a highly respected leader. But I can't recall any occasion on which there was a significant body of opinion within the committee against what Bill Martin wanted to do. Bill Martin usually carried the committee with him, but frequently with dissents, one or two or three people. And that's the way policy got changed.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't Bill Martin acting independently of the committee. He acted through the committee. And the committee usually went along with him. They were all looking at the same data.
Mm-hmm.
Although Bill Martin had additional sources of information. He had a high regard for the statistical output of the Fed and for the interpretations which the professional staff placed upon those statistics. But for Bill Martin, that wasn't enough. He would get on the phone and he would talk with business leaders, with labor leaders, with people in agriculture. He had a whole network of contacts of people that he would get a lot of anecdotal information, which he would range alongside all the economic data and analysis that had been placed before him and come to his conclusions. I'll tell you one other little thing about him. He used to have an apartment in New York City, and he would come up to the city from time to time, and on a Saturday afternoon, he would go over to the theater district in Broadway, and there'd be people lined up to go to the theater, and the Saturday matinees in the theater attracted not just New Yorkers, but people from all over the country, and he would wander up and down the lines chatting with people from Iowa, people from Michigan, people from here and there, and he got a pretty good idea of what was going on. So he was a remarkable fellow, is what I'm saying, and he exercised his leadership not independently of the committee, but through the committee. Mm-hmm. That's my conclusion, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I would agree with that. Let me come back to free reserves for a minute. Who actually specified the free reserves targets? Who actually came up with the numbers? Was that done in consultation with the...
The answer is nobody. And I'll explain that.
Okay.
We go into a committee meeting, and over the preceding few weeks, the free reserves would have fallen out within a certain range. And sometimes they get out of that range, usually because of the misbehavior of float.
Mm-hmm.
If I would sit there in New York, and if I look at the weather map sometimes, and if I'd see the whole central part of the country fogged in, I'd know very well that float was going to explode in the next day or two.
Right.
And so setting that kind of thing aside, free reserves had, for the preceding few weeks, had been within a certain range. And we'd go to a committee meeting, and if the committee wanted to ease up, they wouldn't give me any new, or my predecessor, any new free reserve target. They would just say policy should be easier, be a bit easier. I mean, it's just as general as that.
Mm-hmm.
I would get a sense from the discussion. I would get a sense of how much easier. I would just make a judgment about how much easier and how, and I translated that into free reserves in my own mind and acted accordingly at the desk.
But when the committee says easier, they really mean short-term rates lower.
But they didn't say that.
Mm-hmm.
Reasons I mentioned earlier. You weren't supposed to talk about targeting rates.
Sure. Then you came up with a consistent free reserves target.
Yeah, I know. They want to ease a little bit, and if free reserves had been, say, between 200 and 400 million,
mm-hmm.
I'd say, well, or whatever the number was, I'd say, well,
mm-hmm.
They don't want to ease so aggressively that I should push free reserves up to 600 or 800 million.
Mm-hmm.
I'd make them, say, 3 to 5 or 4 to 6.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll try that, and we'll see what happens. We
so, I mean, the feeling is that if you have an explicit target and you miss it, that you, that makes you look bad?
Oh, it makes you look bad, and it's needless to accept that risk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to bear in mind that the Fed always has a chief congressional critic. There's a lot of critics, but one is always a chief congressional critic. Right now is Henry Gonzalez.
Yeah, it was Wright Patman.
In those days, it was Wright Patman. And there were others, Proxmire in the Senate. So why give these people ammunition when you really don't have to? I think that was his reasoning. So and you could get the result you wanted without giving them ammunition. So they would say the direction of policy should be to ease up, and I would make a judgment from the discussion whether that was a moderate easing, an aggressive easing, or just what. And I would translate that in my own mind into free reserves and short rates, and conduct open market operations accordingly, and go back 3 weeks later, and the committee would have a look at what the results have been, and they could express their satisfaction or dissatisfaction. And if the latter, what to do next.
More specifically, how constraining were the free reserves targets? You could specify a free reserves target that you thought was consistent with the intentions of the committee, but what happens, economic statistics tend to come in strong. People think interest rates are going to be moving up. Banks decide that they want to get into the window later rather than earlier, and at that given free reserves target, say interest rates begin to move up, so that there's potentially a conflict between the free reserves target and the behavior of interest rates. What do you do then?
Well, let me think about that in a minute. I'm trying to think of occasions in which that might have occurred, and I can't think of any.
Well,
I guess I would respond this way. There was always in the background the understanding that if things were to develop in unexpected ways, that I or Al Hayes would just call Bill Martin and have a telephone meeting with the committee. I guess there were a few telephone meetings. I don't recall very many. But when the committee at the end of an open market committee meeting, a judgment was made that policy should ease a bit or tighten a bit, a certain set of expectations flowed from that decision in the minds mm-hmm. of the participants in that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And usually what happened in the market and in interest rates was pretty much within the range of those expectations.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there was not a lot of variability in short-term rates when you were open account manager. So I think the real conflicts.
If events were to unfold outside the range of those expectations, that would be pretty well understood by me, by Al Hayes, by the board staff, by the president mm-hmm. who was on the call. And if we felt sufficiently disquieted, we'd recommend a telephone meeting.
Sure. Would Al Hayes come down to the...
He always came at the 11 o'clock call, yes.
Mm-hmm. Did he occasionally, you know, just come down to the trading, to the desk itself and talk to you, or did he stay away from the desk?
No, he would, he'd always come down to the 11 o'clock call, and mm-hmm. sometimes he'd go in the trading room and watch, we're going to conduct a go-round, he'd come in for a minute and watch it, but he really didn't spend much time there.
you don't remember what date that was, or what?
It must have been in, no, I don't. It must have been in during the time when we were trying to keep short rates up a bit for balance of payments purposes. We wanted to discourage the flow of funds abroad, really, in those days, just to Britain. That was the only well-developed market at that time.
Mm-hmm. So probably fall of 60 or early 61, I suppose.
60, well, it would have been 62, 63, somewhere in there, probably 62.
Mm-hmm. What was the relationship between Martin and Hayes? They basically worked together. It was basically.
I think so. I think it was a cordial relationship and a mutually respectful relationship. They disagreed from time to time. I think I recall only one fairly overt disagreement in the open market committee meeting when the two of them sort of faced each other and had a disagreement. I don't really recall what it was all about, but apart from that, I think it was a cordial relationship.
Well, I get the feeling that Hayes was more willing to raise interest rates for balance of payments for international reasons than was Martin.
That's
and especially
true.
In 61, New York was pushing for an increase in rates that Martin didn't think was desirable. So the minutes are always pretty bland, but I detect some underlying tension in that period.
That's an accurate observation. Al Hayes came to the New York Fed from the New York Trust Company, where he had been the senior international division officer. And his abiding interest was in the international side of the Fed's activities. And he was consistently pushing for higher interest rates as a means of limiting dollar outflows.
But in general, on matters of kind of getting the FOMC across a spectrum, people like Hayes and Balderston were the most conservative, and then gradually over the 60s with Kennedy and Johnston appointees that there became a significant kind of liberal group on the left, and then Martin would have been in the middle, I suppose. Does that sound reasonable?
I'm trying to think of those who might have been on the left. I think it was always a fairly conservative group. During my day,
Mitchell would have been on the.
Mitchell. Yeah, and Dewey. That's right. Dewey Dane was a little bit on the left. George Mitchell more than the others.
Well, tell me about Dewey Dane. I find his name is everywhere, but it's very hard to place a consistent view or perspective for him. Did you have a sense that he had a consistent philosophy about the way he voted? It's just hard to pin him down from things I've read.
I guess I would, if I had to put a label on him, I would label him an intelligent pragmatist.
Mm-hmm. He seemed to work closely with the chairman.
Yes, yeah. I think he was an intelligent pragmatist. He had been, you know, with the Minneapolis Fed, the Richmond Fed, then the Minneapolis Fed, then went to the Treasury, and then from the Treasury to the board as a member. I think he may still be alive. I don't know.
Oh,
He's over
yes.
in Vanderbilt.
Yeah, Yes, I've called him and I've talked to him a number of times, but he's just incredibly busy and he keeps saying, well, yes, you know, I think next month I'll have some time. Let's talk then.
Yeah.
So next month I call back and he says, oh, the dean was just in here and I've got this new project and I do want to talk to you. Let's talk next month. So I'm going to keep at him.
Yeah. So if you can pin him down, I think you'll get a lot out of it.
Yeah, I'm sure I will. But Hayes didn't, because this was really before you came, but Hayes had a different personality than Sproul, didn't he? I mean, Sproul had a kind of dominating sort of personality where he would be willing to confront others.
Yeah.
But Hayes more was kind of someone who would, he would talk things over, but when a decision was made, then he would cooperative.
He was quieter, more conciliatory. Sproul was more combative. And
did you ever meet Sproul, by the way?
Yes, but as a very junior person. I had a couple of two or three exchanges of letters with him later,
mm-hmm.
when I became manager of the account. But do you have his the book, The Selected Papers of Alan Sproul, that was edited by Larry Ritter?
Yes, and I intend, Larry Ritter is still around, I'm sure, and I intend to call him and talk to him, so he would have to be a source of information, because I think Ritter was at the New York Fed in the 50s as an economist.
Yeah, he was, that's right, he was there when I was there. He left to go to NYU.
Hmm. There was really an incredible collection of people who came into the New York Fed in the 50s and then went to the Treasury. And we haven't mentioned Paul Volcker yet. Did you know Volcker while you were
there? Oh, yeah. Paul was in the domestic research, and I was in the foreign research.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any contact with him, or just
not particularly. And we didn't work together because we were in different areas. But mm-hmm. you know, the research department. None of us were officers at the time. We were laboring economists, and we go up to the cafeteria, and we sort of gather together at one table. And Paul was frequently an active and vocal participant. Lots of good, lively discussions at that table in the cafeteria.
Do you remember?
Paul and Henry Kaufman was there, and Al Wolschenlauer and Frank Schott, and it was a good collection of people.
Those are good names. I should talk to Wolschenlauer and Schott. They're still around, and I just need to get their phone numbers and addresses, and I should talk to them.
Well, I can give you Schott's phone number because he lives in the next town here.
Oh, okay.
Before we're through, I can give that to you. I have the phone book right here.
Oh, okay, that's great. Let's see. So, what about the your general impressions in the early '60s about opinions within the administration? The Treasury and the Fed worked pretty closely together. The Treasury people were pretty conservative under Dillon, and of course, a lot of the Treasury people were Fed people at that time.
Oh, Bob Rosa was Undersecretary for Monetary Affairs.
Sure, and then Dewey Dane and Paul Volcker, and then later
and Dewey
on.
Dewey was there, and Paul.
Peter Sternlight.
And Dan Ahern was there.
No, I don't know him.
It was a very good group. that Treasury group, Dillon, Rosa, Dean, Volcker, had a thorn in their side, and the thorn was the Council of Economic Advisers. And Jim Tobin, in particular, was a member of the council, and Walter Heller. And
yes.
They were constantly pressing the Treasury and the Fed to hold interest rates down. And that, of course, gave rise to this idea of Operation Twist. You remember that?
That was basically a way of putting Tobin off.
The whole idea was the Fed had always argued that it didn't want to support any particular bond. price or a quantity.
Right. That, well, that was the pre-accord experience,
yeah.
I think, that made such an impression on the Fed. But
The Fed was arguing, well, we will lose control of reserves if we try to peg a bond rate. And the council came back and said, well, why don't you? You don't have to affect the total quantity of reserves, just sell bills and buy bonds. And total reserves are unchanged, but you've twisted the curve. Short rates be up a little bit, and that'll help on the balance of payments and limit flows abroad. While at the same time, you'll be pushing bond rates down, and with no change in total reserves. Well, it made sense on the face of it, but the Treasury people who had had market experience felt that it was really not a workable proposition for very long, and I certainly felt that way. Anyway, the Fed, under pressure from the Treasury, adopted Operation Twist, all of which was a nod in the direction of the Council of Economic Advisers. And then it fell to me to execute it. And I was accused of executing it in a half-hearted way. That was wrong. It was more like a quarter-hearted way. And
yes, apparently Tobin would persuade President Kennedy to call quadriad meetings when he felt like you weren't buying enough long-term
Tobin, I didn't hear you. What?
It seemed to be kind of enormously like that was monetary policy is the composition of the Fed's portfolio. Tell me
if let me just give you my reason for not executing that with aggressively. I executed that Operation Twist in such a way as to keep the Council of Economic Advisers quiet, or at least keep them from speaking too loudly, while minimizing the disruption to the market. And I say disruption to the market, what do we mean by that? Knowing the market as I do, as I did then, and I think still do, if the market gets the idea that the Fed doesn't want a particular segment of the yield curve to move up in yield, the market comes to look upon the Fed as the residual buyer, and anytime any market participant wants to sell, I'm not talking just about the dealers now, I'm talking about all the big holders of bonds, the banks, the insurance companies, the mutual funds, although they were smaller then, but they were around. I feel there's a residual buyer out there. They can sell without the risk of any capital loss. The market is a different place than when they face a free market, knowing that this or that portfolio adjustment that they want to make might entail the risk of a capital loss. I just didn't want, nobody in the Fed wanted the Fed to come to be viewed as an immutable residual.
If the market didn't know what to expect on the other on the other side, and that was very important in terms of your ability to offset changes in reserves.
We used to call it the certainty of uncertainty.
I've not heard that, but that's a good expression. You mentioned the relationship with the council. Let me ask you some more about that, and particularly getting into 1965 with when Ackley replaced Heller. I get the feeling from looking at documents through that period that the council thought that it was the guardian of aggregate demand, and it was, you know, it was the government agency in charge of controlling expenditure. It was going to do so through the multiplier, and the council really resented the Fed's independence. They really felt like the Fed was making decisions that were their province, and there was a lot of resentment on the part of Heller and especially Ackley toward the Fed doing anything independent. Did you get that feeling?
I really can't respond to that. I did not get that feeling, because maybe I was gone by that at that point. I left in May of 65.
Oh, I see.
But in any case, I never dealt directly with the council. I had a couple of conversations with Tobin and with Heller at a Washington reception. My sense of what the council was doing in these regards came to me through the Treasury people. The council was exerted their pressure, I think, directly on the Treasury. Whether they also had lunch with Bill Martin and exerted pressure on him, I don't know. But I do know they exerted pressure directly on the Treasury.
Mm-hmm. What about...
Never directly on me.
What about pressure arising from the 1964 tax cut? Arthur Okun has written a book on this period, and he makes the statement in it that the council convinced Martin not to raise interest rates in 1964 to offset the tax cut. Does that sound have any ring of
1964?
Yes. And in fact, short-term rates did not change in 64 until the end, until November. That's a statement that Okun makes. I wondered what you think of that.
That strikes me as credible.
Mm-hmm.
Martin, as any chairman, has to be aware, you know, of the Washington environment, and he has to be the guardian of the Fed's independence.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, in order to guard the independence, you have to bend a little bit. And it's perfectly conceivable to me that Martin may have bent under that influence.
I do remember.
But if he felt, I know, knowing Martin as I do, if he felt that that really, if events developed such that he felt that was the wrong thing to do, he would back away from that. As indeed happened at the end of 64. In the latter part of 64, I think it was.
Well, he moved
right to September, something like that. I was on. I took a vacation, and we were supposed to firm up monetary policy.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, presumably it happened after the election, and it does look like from the series I have here that rates started to move up in November, and then December. I mean, the Fed would not have moved rates up right before the 64 election. Would it? Doesn't that seem unlikely?
Yeah, not certainly not decisively. I have a recollection of.
I don't know.
I have a recollection of. It may have been August or September. There might have been just a little snugging, to use the term that was then used. You don't really. We don't want to change in policy, but it would be nice to snug up reserves a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That term was used, and I have a feeling we probably did a little snugging in around July or August, but not enough to. In those days, the market now, of course, watches the Fed very closely, as indeed they did in those days, but the Fed now targets the federal funds rate, and every time the federal funds rate moves and aid the market, attaches great significance to it, and the whole market moves.
Mm-hmm.
One of the great advantages of using free reserves, which you should understand, nobody regarded as an end in themselves, but really as a proxy for short rates. But one of the advantages of using that proxy was that free reserves, the market understood, were not under the absolute control of the Fed. Float and And this made it possible, this kind of thing made it possible for the Fed to undertake a small change in policy without the market knowing it was going on until it was all over. And I remember doing that at the end of 62, for example. I'm doing here and saying that the only argument in favor of free reserves is that the Fed can effect a small or moderate change in policy without inducing a large and unwanted market reaction to it.
Well, it can also let the term structure change. It can let longer-term rates move up, and then, you know, the Fed can say, well, we're following rates, because the market can guess where rates are going if the economy strengthens, and everybody in the market knows where rates are going to have to go. It's just Congress that doesn't.
Yeah.
And then as, you know, somewhat longer-term rates begin to move up, then the Fed can follow rates up, and it looks like a natural thing to do, but it makes a lot of sense. So.
Yeah.
I never understood why Burns moved away from those procedures. I've never been able to, never had anybody kind of give me any convincing. He kept things to himself, so he probably never told anyone. But why he moved to an explicit rate peg, I don't understand. Except that, you know, he seemed to feel like he could control everything, and maybe overestimated what he could control. You made a comment about congressional critics. The person who made the most noise at that time was Patman. But
right, Patman.
What about the Senate side? You mentioned Proxmire, especially in 65. Well, especially 66, the Fed was under pressure from Congress. Do you remember any thing on the Senate side? Critics, Sparkman, for example, was he supportive of the Fed? Do you know anything about that? Sparkman from Alabama, he was on the Senate banking.
No, committee. I don't really remember. I remember earlier Paul Douglas was that goes back in the early 50s. I think he was not so much a critic as he was a sort of a gadfly.
Yeah.
I think the Senate did. I think
Douglas was critical over the discount rate increase in December 65, so he was not helpful to the Fed at that time.
Who was that?
Paul Douglas. He was not helpful later on at that point.
Right. I don't remember anybody in the Senate being as prominent a critic as Patman was in the House.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember, even after you left the Fed, the pressure, after you left the Fed, the political pressures really converged on the Federal Reserve System. Congress became concerned when the housing industry became concerned over high interest rates, and of course Ackley wanted to run policy through fiscal policy with low interest rates. Did you follow that period after you left the Fed?
Well, not nearly as closely, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't have.
Do you have any sense of how much committed Martin was to the Johnson surcharge, and how willing he was to keep rates down in early 66 when the surcharge was being debated in Congress?
This was the income tax surcharge?
Yeah, and the role of the New York Fed. I mean, that must be an interesting period for the New York Fed, because the dollar was under attack, and the Fed was very slow to move rates up. My understanding is that Martin was concerned that if he moved rates up sharply, Congress would say, well, we don't need the income tax surcharge. The Fed's done the dirty work for us. Did you have any
I really don't. You might talk to Peter Sternlight about that. Have you talked to Peter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've talked to Peter Sternlight and Paul Meek. Actually, Peter seemed kind of just more into the kind of technical aspects of it. Paul Meek had some more general sorts of observations about it. Anyways, they were both useful to talk to. Do you have any general feelings about Martin as an economist? What did he think caused inflation?
Martin, as an economist, I don't think he had any formal economic training.
Mm-hmm.
He came from a banking family, and there's probably a lot of dinner table discussion about economic and financial matters.
Yeah, his father was governor of the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank. So.
And then, of course, at a very early age, he was the president of the New York Stock Exchange.
Right.
So he had a broad background in economics and finance, not just broad, but some depth to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
I used earlier the term anecdotal information in describing the kind of data that Martin liked to acquire and take into account. And I think that really describes it. I don't think you couldn't say that he was in any particular follower of any particular school of economics. Monetarism wasn't much heard of in those days.
Right, but, yeah, he had no use for the money supply.
I don't think he would be a monetarist.
No.
I think he would take a very eclectic approach to policy making, gathering information from all kinds of sources, some of it highly sophisticated economic data, and others other information, the result of all those conversations with a wide range of people throughout the country. Come to his conclusions. He was a complex man. I often thought as I listened to him and the statements he made in open market committee meetings, I thought this man is an impressionist painter. He's not a realist. If he had a canvas in front of him, you wouldn't have the stark outlines of a tree and a mountain and so on. You would have dabs here and dabs there and dabs there. But when you stood back and looked at it, everything would come together with great clarity. I don't know whether I'm making myself clear here.
Yeah, I think
his was a strong analytical intelligence and a very, very strong intuitive intelligence, and the two blended very well in him.
I think maybe I would put it a little differently. He didn't think of himself as an economist, but
no,
I think that in terms of not in terms of the Keynesian economists at the time, but I think he must have had a very strong sense that there's no such thing as a free lunch. And given the Keynesian tenor of the times, that stood in contrast to the political environment in which he was working.
He was eclectic.
He must have been extraordinarily ambitious. If you look at his career, I mean, youngest head of the New York Stock Exchange, moved up rapidly in everything he did, yet he must have had an ability to not intimidate people, to make people feel comfortable with him. So he must have combined this ability to be on top, to run a large organization without coming across as intimidating or aggressive to other people.
That's right. He was a kind and gentle and generous man. At the same time, tough as nails. And I've seen both sides of it.
When did he have to be tough? I understand he had some arguments with Sproul early on over bills only.
Well, yes, and I've seen him. I think he probably from time to time had fairly serious disagreements with one or two members of his own board, and was pretty tough on those occasions.
Later on. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
It was pretty tough in just insisting that that what somebody wanted to do or what somebody wanted to get in the record would in his view, be injurious to the Fed, and said in no uncertain terms that that ought not to be done. But he didn't. He could be tough in that sense.
Apparently, he was willing to take on President Johnson and argue with him in strong. Some of the board later on, reading back through the documents, was really just unabashedly pro-administration. Mazel, for example, when he came on, really seemed more a member of the council than a member of the FOMC. He must have had some. He must have had some occasions to take those individuals on. Remember?
He did. Mazel came on after I was gone, in my recollection.
Yeah. What do you know about Robertson?
He was vice chairman.
Yeah, what do you remember about him? He must have been fairly tough, too.
He was.
During the period when the Fed was under enormous attack in late summer of 1966, Martin was in the hospital, and he was running the show, and that was a time of real real stress for the Fed. He seemed to have done very well.
That's right. Robertson was very vocal,
mm-hmm.
very opinionated, never in doubt.
You mean in expressing himself on the economy and federal
policy? Yes, on policy.
Mm-hmm.
Never in doubt. He was perhaps my toughest questioner, my toughest interrogator. But we had a very good relationship. But if I had done something that he thought was outside the bounds of the directive, he wouldn't hesitate to point that out.
Mm-hmm. So the bill rate went up a tenth of a percentage point, and he thought that was inappropriate.
That's
given
right.
the general statements. There was a literature at the time associated with the name of Guttentag that argued that the desk had too much discretion, that monetary policy to an extent was influenced by the decisions of the desk as opposed to the FOMC. Do you remember any of that discussion?
No, but I knew Jack Guttentag. He was, when I was running the open market account, Jack was an economist in the research department of the New York Fed.
Yeah, this is the paper he wrote after he went
right,
to the
board. Right, and we used to invite an economist from the research department to spend 3 or 4 weeks at a time at the trading desk to broaden their experience and give them a little bit of a look into the market and the way it operated. And the quid pro quo for that was that the economist would prepare the first draft of a weekly report that the manager of the account sent to the Fed.
Right.
And I remember Jack always, right from the very first week he was there, wrote an excellent report.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them were really not very good. You can't expect to take resource department put him at the desk and expect him in the first week or second week to write a regular report. But Jack's were exceptional, is what I'm saying. Now I go back to what I said earlier. At the end of an open market committee meeting, I would get the committee would conclude that policy ought to be firmed up a little or ease off a little or remain about the same. And that word about was frequently in there. And I would translate that into free reserve targets, because the committee never put free reserve targets in the directive. I would translate that into free reserve targets. And Jack, being a very acute observer, probably saw me and my predecessor, Bob Rouse, and later probably Alan Holmes, making these judgments as to what the committee really wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm saying here is I can understand how an acute observer like Jack Goodenthal could have drawn the conclusion that the desk really has too much discretion. I think that conclusion is inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, the committee met every 3 weeks, and if I strayed outside the boundaries of what the committee wanted, I would have heard about it certainly within 3 weeks, no later than 3 weeks, and probably within 3 weeks by a telephone meeting.
Yeah.
So I don't think no committee would let the manager go off and conduct his own policy, not at all.
Sure. I think probably the real point of contention is that Guttentag became a academic, and academics want policy procedures where everything is explicit.
Yeah.
Everything has a number,
right.
And we already talked about that. Why Martin didn't go that route, and I think that's probably what.
You have it exactly right. Yeah. A lot of the academics just couldn't understand why the whole policy making and executing process was so fuzzy. It looked very fuzzy to them. But to those of us involved, it was really not very fuzzy at all. I knew, without being given numbers, I knew what they wanted.
Sure.
And,
well, in general, the academics have no idea, you know, the various sorts of pressures that... the Fed's always under attack. I mean, you know, Gonzalez, you already mentioned the name. Patman, Gonzalez, what's the difference?
The Fed has been pretty...
Not much.
It's always going to have a congressional critic, and the Fed has been blessed with inept ones.
During the FOMC meetings, there would be a break, a coffee break in the middle. Would you get together with...
not in my day. We started at 9 and end up around 11:30 or 12. No breaks.
Okay, so there would be no period where you would get together with Robertson and Martin and talk things over to come up with a consensus statement. That must have developed later on. Because I think Sternlight mentioned that as a practice, so that must have been something that happened.
Yeah, something happened later.
Yeah. I've basically, you know, run through particular questions. Do you have any sense of any kind of feelings about why monetary policy was basically pretty good in terms of preventing inflation through the middle to late 60s, and why we had so many problems later on, other than the obvious political pressures? Could the Fed have done things differently to have kept the lid on in the 70s the way it did in the 50s and 60s?
Let me rephrase the question and see if I have it accurately. I look back upon the early 1960s as a time in which the performance of the economy was very good. There were good annual increments to real income, increasingly better distributed, with little or no inflation. zombie performance. My Fed contributed importantly to that performance, and now the question is, how come, why?
Yeah.
My sense of it is that in earlier periods of recession, the Fed eased monetary policy very aggressively, down to the point of, to use the expression I used earlier, down to the point of sloppy reserves.
Mm-hmm. Some people say it was Kennedy's father who was insistent on that.
But there was the balance of payments constituted a policy constraint that was not there earlier and probably in later years should have been, but was not.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think that accounts for it. Yeah. Government behaved with moderation. Government can often be a disequilibrating force.
Anything else you want to? Do you feel like there are things that you'd like to tell me about later policy? I feel like we've kind of covered a lot of the things I was interested in. I've learned an awful lot, and I appreciate it. Did we miss things?
No. I'll just tell you about one little anecdote.
Sure. Anything you can tell me in
about,
terms of
Bill Martin and Roy Chapman.
Yeah, anything, that's the kind of thing that's not in the record. So anything you can tell me about individuals or, people you remember, Al Hayes or Holmes or Rouse or people like that that makes them a little bit of human. Those are the kinds of things that get lost, and I'd appreciate, hearing them.
There was an open market committee meeting on a particular day in 62 or 3 or 4, somewhere around there, and right. Oh, wait a minute. It was, I can tell you when it was. It was after, it must have been around January or February of 1963. It was after the midterm elections of 1962.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Patman was chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee. And some new faces came into Congress in that 1962 election.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those new faces came onto his committee. And Mr. Patman called Bill Martin and said he would like to have Martin and the entire Open Market Committee appear in January or February, whenever it was, appear at an in
Yeah, they were trying to get the committee minutes at that time. They were secret. Yeah, I remember that.
And so Martin summoned the entire open market committee and staff, which included me, and Charlie Coombs as manager for foreign activity, to Capitol Hill. And he had Patman sat up on the dais and had a raid around him. All of the members of his committee, many of them new faces. And my thought was, this old guy is just trying to impress all these new people with his authority over the Fed. And I guess we got there around 10:30 or something like that in the morning, 10:45. And Patman made the mistake of asking Bill Martin to introduce his associates. And Martin started off. At first, introduced Canby Baldiston, who was the vice chairman. Then went through and introduced every member of the board. Then he went to the presidents of the banks, to Al Hayes, and he just gave the biographies of all these people, and he was still going strong an hour and a half later. And Patman's committee members started looking at their watches and drifting off to go to lunch. And in the end, Patman only got to ask one or two questions, and it was time for him to go to lunch. Bill Martin conducted the most brilliant filibuster I've ever heard. Patman never really got an opportunity to ask the question. He tried to interrupt Martin several times, but Martin would have none of it. He had to introduce his colleagues. And
Patman actually came up to the New York Fed a couple of times, didn't he?
He came up to the New York Fed. That was after the debacle in 58 with the 2 5/8. The government, that speculative bubble burst, and a lot of people got hurt. A lot of little people got hurt.
Yeah.
And Congress heard about this, and Patman came up to conduct an investigation. And he had this committee installed up the courthouse in Foley Square in New York. And there were various dealers appeared as witnesses, Jerry Spencer of Solomon Brothers and a few others whose names I now forget. And I think my predecessor, Bob Rouse, appeared as a witness in that. And after those hearings, Mr. Patman brought his committee down to the New York Fed. And I'll never forget that a group of us were in Al Hayes' office with Mr. Patman, not his entire committee at that point. The rest of his committee was elsewhere in the Fed, but Patman and two or three others. Patman said to Hayes, now, Mr. Hayes, I want to take a look at the member bank reserves. And Hayes raised his eyebrows and then proceeded to try to explain to Patman that member bank reserves were not to be found in a vault downstairs in a big war chest of some sort, but they were deposits on the books of the Fed. He'd be glad to have the accounting department show them the books, but that's what the reserves were. And Patman really found that very difficult to accept, that the Federal Reserve really didn't have any reserves after all. They're only bookkeeping entries. So that's the kind of thing they were dealing with.
He was famous. He would make surprise trips to Richmond and come into our accounting department and ask, randomly pull out invoices and then require us to justify them. So Richmond had to justify why it did not buy the cheapest ballpoint pen available. And also, we had to write a memo justifying why we got the Washington Post in the library. Anyways.
Well,
yeah. You mentioned the names of a couple other people. You mentioned John Larkin, and then...
I haven't been in touch with John for a year or two. I'll give him a call.
Okay.
And see, I don't know whether he's even well or not. If he is, I think he probably would be glad to talk with you. Mm-hmm. So I will call him.
What was his... I've seen his name on the list of system personnel, but what was his position?
Well, he was the number two man at the trading desk,
mm-hmm.
Bob Rouse, all during the early 50s, during the
I'd love to talk to you.
The decade before I arrived at the desk.
Sure, I'd love to talk to him. I've talked to Spencer Marsh.
Oh yeah, well.
He's very interesting. His perspective is a little more as a trader,
yeah,
as opposed to an economist. I could write Mr. Larkin a letter if you had his address and then see whether he responded.
Well, let me call him. I think it might be better that way.
Okay, then.
If he is willing to do that,
mm-hmm,
I will call you back.
Okay.
Give you his number.
Okay. And you said you had a phone number for Al. Wojnalauer or
Frank? No, Frank Schott.
Frank Schott. Okay.
Yeah, hold on a minute. Okay. My phone book out. Frank was really never close to the open market desk. You know,
mm-hmm.
Frank was an economist in the foreign research area, and he and I worked together in the Latin American unit. We wrote joint papers on Brazilian coffee and Chilean copper and so on.
Well, when did he leave the Fed? You know,
my recollection. I'd guess mid '60s, something like that.
Mm-hmm.